Hello, welcome back. The work back in Europe here before, not work back in Europe somewhere else, unfortunately. So we're about to start the final round of, or the final 2 hour stretch of the conference. We're starting with Tom Steinberg on the state of public sector, public interest technology, I should say. The state of public interest technology. We then have Sue and Pam of AWS today on talking about AWS, why that's got Sue. And then we have Jamie Lear talking about the climate symphony with their live performance. I'll hand over to Tom.
I'm enjoying Open Tech today so much. On the day that I stood with my wife at the front of the aisle when I got married and I looked out, I saw fewer familiar faces than I saw. This is really, you are my choir, enjoy. I thought I'd talk about the state of public interest technology. I'm aware that this is a little bit jungly, but I just simply don't want you to get bogged down. This could be called the state of tech for good. It could be just called any number of other things. We'll get there. What is it not? So what is it not about? It's actually not about all the James Wall things you heard about before. It's not about fake news and hacking and all the terrible things going on with the internet right now. And that's partly because I want to keep this shorter, but also just because you've probably already heard so much about the stuff you want to die. So instead, when I talk about this being a sort of state of the nation thing, this is to some extent a state of the nation for the very little nation that it has been for some time. Explicitly trying to use technology to make the world better in some way. That's for the people who've been doing it mainly. For the one of you who doesn't know who I am, I started a society a few years ago, we built things like this, and these days I am a national lottery, a big lottery fund, which is where a lot of national lottery money goes, and I run the digital team there, and I try and take a fairly traditional grant maker and pull it into the 21st century. This is probably also my time of saying, of course, nothing I'm about to say is official big lottery fund policy. So, let's start by celebrating some things that are going really well within the field of tech for good or public interest tech or whatever you want to call it. I thought it's important in some ways to celebrate things that have been around such a long time. We may not even remember that they were important and innovative. So, I'm not a parent, but the fact that Mumsnet gets 7 million monthly users within this country, and then there's also NetMums, which gets a significant share of the same. This is tremendous. This is an amazing kind of human resource. I am assured by a lot of people I know who have parents that they've answered a lot of problems or just about new worries from having spent time on here. It's not a non-profit. The people from Mumsnet wouldn't often turn up to an event like this, but it's just worth noting that this is a really significant kind of good thing for the world. There are probably kids who will be like less screwed up because their parents were kind of read some basic advice. Similar, also old, also not a non-profit, is Money Saving Expert. Twice as big. Absolutely fantastic in terms of being a thing that stops people getting ripped off by the bastards. Right? And does it for loads of people, and the guy who found it there got very rich, and that's him getting some kind of gong. I don't know, I don't recognise honours, but so, he's not only built a thing that people in Britain want to use to not get ripped off by the bastards, but the establishment, to some extent, has recognised that what this project represents is a good thing. Even more obvious, even I can't even see, is obviously Wikipedia. I didn't even bother getting numbers, it's just used by everybody. At the less fluffy end of the scale, I'm putting the next one up because you're probably actually quite annoyed by this company, but we mustn't forget that this is a fantastic public interest internet usage, which 10 years ago we had all been pretty excited about, which is all of the really annoying price comparison websites, which, again, stop people getting ripped off by the bastards, which in a public interest way is a great use of the internet. It's like when those of us started a little while ago, we got excited about how the world might be made better. The idea that you might use, the website so that the person trying to, buy something doesn't get ripped off by the bastards. The fact that they have a really meaningful tool that would really help them avoid that was a great thing. So these are all things from the consumer parts of people's lives, and these are very robust. There's some good business models there, there's lots of traffic, and there's even some degree of political influence. But of course, the other thing that's going on is the world of public interest technology that is that is intervening in politics. Now, I said I wasn't going to talk about all the negative stuff, so you're just going to have to imagine for a second all of the 3.5 hour conversation we could turn back and things gone wrong because of the modern internet. But here's the Prime Minister of Iceland resigning because the Panama Papers basically got him. It's worth noting that there's a huge load of different public interest tech that allowed this to happen, right? So first thing, we needed the web at all, so that the web could be a platform upon which people could build secure communication technology, so you could do things like upload leaked documents, because that's what the Panama Papers are. Then once those leaked documents were relatively securely uploaded, and there were 11 terabytes of them. So how on earth were you going to find out what this guy had done if you had it on paper? It would have just been impossible. So the people, the many hundreds of journalists who worked together on this story, were assisted by some very kind of invisible technologists who built some reasonably good technology that really helps you deal with the fact that, you know, it's difficult when someone dumps 10 terabytes of stuff in which there might be one interesting story. So I think this is, you know, it's a really interesting kind of, it's an invisible public interest tech story that is both very visible at the same time, because when this story broke in the UK last year, it led most of the newspapers for 6 or 7 days in a row. So another thing that's really great, apart from the kind of the more powerful kinds of investigation, is that just so many people are excited by tech for good at the moment. This is a screenshot from the London Tech for Good meetup. We've got a couple of screenshots here that are just taken from different web pages. There's the Tech for Good meetup, 5,400 members in London. And the one on the right-hand side is a really rubbish screenshot from Tech Refugees that shows about 6,000 people as members of Tech Refugees. So there's some big communities. There are communities that are essentially public interest tech, and they'll kind of dwarf the one that is so brilliantly represented here today. There's also there's things like Code Club, Volunteers Who Help People program, which we now claim that the number of schools doing volunteer-run coding clubs is now like well above 10,000. And then I'm leaving kind of the best of last, because it's had sort of like a tough time of late, but actually the biggest single public interest tech success, if you will, in this country, is the fact that the government digital service did happen at all. It came out of nowhere. It did some projects that have made big concrete differences to people's lives, which I think is, you can't get much more concrete than this. The adding a link to a single page on a website and getting a ton more organ donors, that's like pretty much, in my view, the exemplar. That's the I could die happy now version of working in public interest technology. But that's not all they did, of course. There's lots of efficiency things. Here's an aerial photo of the DVLA office in Swansea, where you can see just about, if you look, the special truck bays they used to have, so the massive trucks could come in and leave enormous amounts of paper, people applying for tax discs, and people applying for driving licenses, and you know, those trucks aren't needed so much, they can get rid of those bays because huge inefficiencies are gone. Also, just as a single, oh my god, how the world has changed thing, this thing you're looking at is not a normal aerial photo, this is a photogrammetry screenshot from Google Satellite in 3D, which is just absolutely insane as far as I'm concerned, but that's an aside. And actually, even though most of us know that the government digital service has been having a sort of like a down slump after its high, it's done a thing that all good religions know is really, really important, right? Because if what you know if your religion is, you're going to have a period when you're really popular, and when your leader is like, you know, is really the man traditionally, and then there's going to be a period where you're persecuted and out in the cold and everything's really difficult and horrible. And what's really important, really important, if you're going to survive that, is you need to leave a book. And they left the book. And this is the government service design manual. And for those of you who haven't so much time in government, and maybe for whom the government digital service, it represents things more like more visible achievements, like building gov.uk and making it better. This is the real significant long-term achievement right now, because this is the manual that says, this is how we do things now. Right? And it doesn't matter whether or not the people who wrote this book then grow old or die or go away. This is the government. If this is the book, that book will stick, it will have influence. In my own job, I found it extraordinarily, stunningly helpful, far more helpful than being able to point to Google or Amazon or Apple or anyone and say, look at what they did to the world, look how they changed the world. The ability to look and say, look, see this is a book, and it says the government, it says the government's book. government's logo on the top. So we as a bit of the government, we should do what the book says. That is massively, massively important and powerful, and nothing about, you know, a kind of temporary Whitehall kind of, I don't know, you know, infighting or whatever, will change the fact that you can't undo that book any more than you can sort of, like, undiscover sort of, like, nuclear chain reactions, right? It's out there now. And I think that that ultimately, as we meet as a community here, this book is probably our single greatest legacy as a group inside the UK. So that is a super quick summary of some of the things that I think are brilliant. I know I missed a bunch of brilliant things that I even heard about today, being told about today. But here are some of the reasons why we should be cheerful, because about a decade ago, many of us thought maybe we can use the internet to make people's lives a lot better without just doing it in a completely straightforward commercial way. And the answer is, yeah, we seem to be right. That was a good thesis. That was correct. But now there's some buts. And the number one, especially if you're about as old as me, is that we are being disrupted ourselves. It's happened to us after we did it to everybody else. So, we've been disrupted in a couple of different ways, and here's one of them. This is coming. You might not be able to see what it is because it's not very good. That's an Amazon Echo, that's an Alexa. When I say this is coming, I actually don't mean specifically this one particular product from this one particular company. I mean new devices that are totally closed platforms that are the epitome of the opposite of the open web, and that don't respect privacy. Because I know, yes, it listens all the time. And I know that that makes a lot of people in this community pretty uncomfortable. And yeah, I'm aware that it sends all the audio straight to Donald Trump. I get that. In fact, look, there he is. He's listening to me and my wife discuss the fact that we didn't know what to say on Open Tech Talks last night. But there is a really important but about this spooky device, right? Which is that these things are just basically totally... Oh, sorry. They are totally, totally fantastic. Sorry, it's an animation I won't play because I don't have to make it play. So, this is simply a guy who loves his, Echo or hugs it. But the platforms are closed. These new things, and when I say new things, I'm here now not just talking about the Echo, I'm talking about your augmented reality glasses when you get them, your virtual reality glasses when you get them, all your Internet of Things devices in your homes. Compared to the fight that we wanted to win when we called ourselves Open Tech, we lost that, right? We really, really lost it in a big and hard way. But there's an important choice for those of us who still want to make the world a better place here, which is, do we work with what we've got, or do we fight? Because right now on today, my friends, my techie friends, they come to my house and they see that I've got one of these Amazon things, and they're like, I can't believe you. You of all people, you know it's listening to you. You know it's sending all your secrets straight to Donald Trump. How can you possibly live with that? And I say, because I have had one for 6 months now. But when I go to someone else's house who doesn't have one, which is to say most people don't have one, my main thought about this house, their house, and I'm like, it's very nice, but it's broken, this house. It's not actually work, because in the future, a house that doesn't listen to you will be like a house with no water or electricity today. Right? Now that is an awful thought if your idea of an always-on microphone connected to an internet is just this is a terrible, terrible thing that like you'd rather die or go to jail. But actually, you're going to get old in nursing homes that behave like this, and you're not going to be locked out unless you're a billionaire. The only people who can live without like this event, who will be able to survive like this, are billionaires. If you're not in that, then you either have to be part of collaborating in this unpleasant new era and coping with it, or, you know, you could go to the shack on the hill. But the moment you go to the shack on the hill, the moment you take that option, the moment you have everything in your life, so it's all your own, you don't have to collaborate with the closed platforms, is you've become a fax person in the web age. You're like the people that you sat here 10 or 15 years ago and you took the piss off because they didn't get it. You've become one of them. So that's not all that's changing, which is that there are people coming along who would describe themselves as public interest tech people, we don't share some of our fundamental assumptions, who think that to some extent we're like, we're a bit weird. This is Arik Chowdhury. Anyone met him? So Arik is 24 or 5. I can't find his age exactly on the internet, even though it's like 2017. He founded 3 years ago a thing called Web Roots Democracy. This is just simply a screenshot. I guess you this, you can't read it in your own fun. There's a series of blog posts about the fact that basically young people aren't going to vote in the election because there is no online voting. Right? Do you hear that groan? That
is... fuck when it comes to mind.
Yeah, that's it. And that's the fundamental difference is he is you 15 years ago with that attitude. He's just as angry as you are. He just thinks that the older people, like you, like us, are just as out of date as we when we were like 20 and looking at the internet. We were looking at 40-year-old TV producers who didn't get it. Now, I know the Russians, I know the Chinese, I know the hacking, I know I get that. So does he. This is what's different is he doesn't look at this problem and go like, do you remember how like Blair-era politicians thought online voting was good because they knew nothing about technology, right? He's a 24-year-old internet native who set up a digital organization. But he wants that to be online voting because his generation sees it as, yeah, we can fight the Russians in cyberspace and have an online election, or we can not fight them, we can not have an online election, and then old people can screw me and my generation forever. So he's willing to take that fight. He's like, this looks like two terrible outcomes, and he's like, you know what, a generation that's really brilliant at security engineering, a generation that's better than our parents at security engineering, we can build an election system that is good enough for us because the alternative is that we're ruled forever by people that we hate. So he's just, I'm picking on Paul O'Rourke because like, he's such a kind of such a great example. Even the fact that there were audible groans in the audience is a great example. He is you 15 years ago, right? But that isn't even the biggest thing. So there's two big changes to this exciting, positive field that are coming. But actually, this here is the biggest one, which is I think we're in a world now where the first question pretty much always has to be, is this public interest budget for GAFA or is it for us? Now, for those of you who've been living under a rock, GAFA, Google, Amazon, Facebook, Apple, Facebook, Amazon, it could be any large tech companies. If we're in China, it would be different, of course. And here's a really important thing to know about these companies, especially if you don't pay a lot of attention to this, which is, they're really great at specifically public interest tech products. Now, just to be clear here, I don't mean, for example, one of the best public interest tech products ever is Google Spreadsheets Online, right? I imagine most of us have used that to make the world better in some way, shape, or form. But Google didn't build it so we can make the world better. They just built it so they could kill Microsoft, right? But they're also pretty good at intentional, specific public interest tech projects. So, here's a screenshot from an Android phone. It's a pop-up alert, flash flood warning, avoid, watch out. This is literally a phone warning that is like, this could save your life. Like, look at Bing, oh, I'm not going to die now. That's a pretty great feature, right? here's Facebook. Facebook and Google both come together, not really Apple. Remind people to vote. They remind people to vote a lot. And their evidence they publish suggests that they succeed. They send a ton of people to go and vote who wouldn't otherwise vote. A really old example here that is really great because not so many people know about them. This is pretty much the first time that any of these companies ever did anything special in the public interest, and it's still there, which is if you Google for suicidal terms, they actually inject special things in your feed that have been optimized in an attempt to get you to phone Samaritans or the equivalent of Samaritans in your country rather than get through with it. So these big companies, while they're mainly about selling efforts and they're mainly about some hardware and stuff, you can't get away from the fact that the products that they build in the public interest are pretty great. They know how to do it. They know how to do it really well because they're pretty good at the internet. But it raises a pretty tough question. What are the rest of us now all for, right? As an example, as a project, so I've chosen a project which I think might not involve anyone here and it doesn't come from the organization I used to work for, so this is picking an example that is like outside our cultural reference point. So Good Sam is a great idea. It is an app that runs in this country, and it allows people who are trained in sort of CPR and emergency response, they can put an app on their phone, and what will happen is other people can put an app on their phone, and when and if you see someone basically collapse in the street, of course you phone 999, that's the obvious thing you do, but at the same time, after you've spoken to 999, or in fact, almost like it might be at the same time you phone 999, it sends a ping to the CPR trained volunteers who have voluntarily installed the application, and it obviously doesn't send it to everyone, it sends it to people within like 1 mile or whatever, and it says, someone's just like about to die over here, please come as fast as possible, right? And they have at least one story to tell to the new, where basically those people got there before the ambulance, and so you know, it was good. It was probably a lifesaver, right? So, lovely idea, cannot fault that. That is a beautiful public interest tech idea. It understands geolocation technologies, it understands network effects, it understands all sorts of things, right? But let's be real, wouldn't this be better if it was in Android on us, right? Wouldn't it be better if, it, like, every time I just dial 999 or 911 in America, like, the moment I finish, the moment I hang up with 999, wouldn't it be good if my totally default, totally stock iPhone said, put a set of stuff in front of me going, we can also tell other people, or we already are telling other people, you know, press here to kind of, like, interact with those other people. Clearly, for this kind of product, which is huge reward, the reward is people don't die, but the usage level is really low because people don't collapse in the street very often. This is the epitome of something that will work better if it's in a billion phones than if it's on even a million phones won't get brilliant penetration. And so here's you know, that's a tough question, which those people have built with right now. But in 2017, wouldn't it be better in the iOS? And in particular, the bigger question, what actually wouldn't be natively by these companies, because they can integrate in the user interface up front, they can make it so you never have to open a special app, you don't have to go to a special web page, they can just monitor your situation and go, oh my god, you probably need this right now, right? And they can force it to you, they can even wake you up in the middle of the night and go like, you really, really, really should do this, right? They have an access to their users, which is better than any app developer in the world, not because they have better app developers, but because they have access to permissions. Right? And they can drop things in the Google search results, they can drop things in the middle of your feed, they can push you alerts, no one else is allowed to do that, not at scale. So, this is a bit of a kind of bummer, because does this mean that our future, as people who want to build public interest tech, is just to be back-end suppliers to these people? Well, if it is, we've got a lot of problems, because how do you talk to them? Where are they? There isn't like a obvious sort of apply here to have your amazing idea embedded in iOS. Even if it would be, you know, those people who built that good Sam app, have they ever spoken to anyone in like in the Apple iOS team? Who knows? How would they? Because there's certainly, I can't go to Apple's site and find a page that goes, here's what you have to do if you want to integrate things into our operating system. How do you pay for it? Especially because part of the way that people pay for things is, well, it's have brands and reputations, and so you go, yeah, I'm from, as I used to be, I'm from my site, we do great stuff, you can see it, you go to this website, it's my site, and then you should give us money because we make the world a better place. That's the same way that Oxfam works, that's the same way that Save the Children works, but what happens when Oxfam and Save the Children just become features inside iOS, right? Like, which are beautifully and perfectly and seamlessly integrated into your bank account, so you never even need to get out your credit card because they're just so gorgeously done. And that's a toughie, because even if we can find out how to interact, how we pay for it. And I think here, this to turn back to optimism, this I think is why everyone should spend a lot of time talking to Democracy Club, who I think, despite the fact they only work in one area, I think that they represent probably one of the most interesting signals of public interest tech in the future, which is that, yeah, they've got their web page. Who do I vote for? They built the user interface, fantastic. But what really matters about Democracy Club is that they did work out how to talk to Google on Facebook. They did work out how to get things into Google's homepage. They did work out how to get into that system. Maybe they're beginning to work out how to pay for it. You know, it's kind of hard to tell. But the thing is that they are...
Coming to us now.
I think that even though this is only within the narrative of democracy, and I've been talking a lot more about health and stuff, then there is... it's just really worth studying that, because I have a feeling that this may be the way that a load of public interest stuff has to go. But ultimately, we need somehow to get the internet giants to get good at signing on to social contracts, to go like, and this is not, of course, just limited to this stuff, this is now expanding the idea of everything about tax and about censorship and so on. But somehow we've got to turn them. And that's a big puzzle for me, and I hope it maybe is a big puzzle for most of you. So, thank you very much.
do that. No, no, it's pointing in the right direction. Right. Shall I just crack on? Right. Hi, I'm Sue Charman Amazon. I'm the founder of Ada Love, They Say. And what I'm going to do today is just give you a brief overview of what we've been up to for the last few years. It's been a while since I've talked to OpenTech about Ada Love, They Say. And I'm also going to give you an idea of what is coming up for us this year and going forwards. So for those of you who don't know, Ada Love, They Say is an international celebration of the achievements of women in science, technology, engineering, and maths. And we actually started as a day of blogging about women in technology, which actually seems quite quaint now. But we gathered people on the wonderful and sadly now defunct PledgeBank. And we had about 2,000 people who signed up to the pledge. Even though PledgeBank didn't like me asking for 1,000 people, are you sure? That's a lot of people. We got another 1,600 people signed up to an event on Facebook. And it was very clear from the beginning that although this was about women in technology, that it immediately expanded to women in STEM, whether I wanted it to or not, because people immediately started blogging about Marie Curie and Florence Nightingale, who definitely STEM and not technology. So blogging has sort of fallen out of fashion these days. It's not something that people focus on so much, and the day has just naturally evolved to become more about events. So we have an annual STEM cabaret that we put on in London every October. This is Fran Scott, Lighting Things on Fire, which I'm always about. And we bring 7 or 8 women together from different areas of STEM across the UK to talk about their work, give them a platform to actually share what they're doing. So we've had talks about why we laugh, about the ExoMars rover and the hunt for life on Mars, how to grow bone for bone grafts, and how to build a comet. If you want to know how to build a comet, we have a talk on YouTube about that. And so this year it's the 10th of October at the Royal Institution, and this is our big kind of annual focus. But again, so very organically, this was not my idea, this was not something I could take credit for. People started organising their own Ada Love, They Say events around the world. So in 2015, that was Ada Lovelace's bicentenary. We had 150 events around the world, including the one I'm most proud of, which is the one in Antarctica. So we do that every year. People just spontaneously think it's a good idea to organise, maybe it's a hackathon or a Wikipedia editathon or a conference or even maybe just a pub quiz. And there's a place in Porrock, which is has a connection to Ada Love, They Say herself, where they organise a cream tea every year, which is wonderful. We published 2 books about women in STEM, and these are the authors, again, from around the world, taking a look at a whole variety of women. Everyone from people that you've heard of, like Florence Nightingale, are talking about her work as a statistician, as opposed to the lady with the lamp. They're trying to rethink how we view some of the famous women in STEM, and also looking at women who are maybe less well-known, and groups of women as well, not just individuals. So people like the Air Transport Auxiliary were a group of women who flew aircraft around the UK during the Second World War, and many of them died doing it. We've also produced a free education pack for teachers, which includes these and a couple of other posters. These are good career posters. The big, amazing, enormous STEM careers posters is basically data about A-levels, university degrees, and potential careers afterwards, which even 18 months after we published it, is still one of our most popular things that we've ever done. Small range of merchandise, more posters about Ada Lovelace, about Mary Anning, paleontologist, and the obligatory t-shirt, which I totally forgot to bring with me and I'm not wearing today. Recently, last year, we launched a podcast about women in STEM. So we talked to a woman about her work. So we have talks about plastic engineering and solar PV, talks about what it is to be a bubble physicist, what does a bubble physicist do, also really fascinating stuff. And we also talk about historic women's contributions, where I have learned about all sorts of women I'd never even heard of. So we've had people like Dr. Helen Chersky, Dr. Sue Black, Jim Alcalini, Helen Scales, Simon Singh, Abby Hutty, loads of really interesting people on our podcast. And then last year we launched a database of resources. So this includes information about organisations that support women in STEM, funding opportunities if you want to apply for a grant, academic studies, media coverage, and more educational resources for teachers. So we have not been slacking, and we continue to expand our work. So it really is an evergreen, all year round organisation, but it's not just about today. So this year, a project that I've been wanting to do for a while, and I love that now crochet is work. It's fantastic. So this is the idea, is that there are very few inspirational dolls for young girls who are interested in STEM subjects. So we are creating free crochet patterns online for dolls of women in STEM. So we have Mae Jemison, first woman of colour in space, and then the other one there is Dr. Eugenie Clark, who is also known as the Shark Lady. She was a marine biologist who kind of introduced scuba diving to marine biology and, oddly enough, quite liked sharks. So the next person that we're doing, whom I will be starting next week, is a woman called Tu Youyou, who discovered artemisinin, I knew I wouldn't be able to say that, and dihydroartemisinin, which are used to treat malaria and have saved millions of lives. So we are looking at inspirational figures and providing a way for people to make their own dolls of women in STEM, because let's face it, Mattel is never going to do that. Also this year, we are working on a report about role models. So obviously Ada Lovelace Day is very much focused on creating new role models to inspire girls who are interested in STEM, but also to inspire women in STEM, because being a woman in STEM, it's very easy to get a bit dispirited at all of the roadblocks that you face and the constant, whichever idiot company did something stupid this week, there's so many of them. You need a bit of inspiration, you need a sort of feeling that, you know, other people have done this and I can do this too. But we also know that role models aren't a case of one role model fits all. There is much more nuance to making role models successful, actually inspiring girls. So we know, for example, that if a role model tries to take too many stereotypes on at once, that it actually backfires. We know also that presenting role models as perfect backfires, that children will study harder at science if they hear about the challenges that the people that they look up to also face. So we're doing a big report, should be out hopefully in the autumn. So that is kind of much of what we're doing. The big thing for me this year, though, is really tackling something that is slightly adjacent to role models. And this is, you are literally the first people I'm announcing this to. This isn't on our website, I haven't announced it on Twitter. We are looking at an online recruitment fair for women in STEM, which we will run online in November, so that we can bring together women in STEM with employers who are looking to recruit. There are some fairly big issues that are faced, not just by women, but also by employers. We have a shortage of in certain skill sets, and we cannot, as a country, afford to let 50% of the workforce go to waste because we can't connect them with the right jobs. So I want to talk a little bit more about like exactly what the issues are and why we're doing this. Some of the information and statistics that I've been gathering over the last few months are quite interesting and surprising. So for example, men are more likely to have a job directly after graduation, less likely to have a job directly after graduation than women. But when women get jobs after graduation, they are more likely to be low-quality jobs. So what's happening is that the guys are holding out for a better job and often moving home in order to be able to do that, whereas women are taking whatever jobs they can get. So this means that we're not connecting women with the higher-quality jobs. That also is a part of the problem with the gender pay gap, that women are starting their careers at lower pay levels. So as they progress, they stay sort of stuck at lower pay levels because they've taken low-quality jobs. Part of this as well is because we know confidence is a problem. We know that confidence is a problem as well. So for women, they tend to underestimate their abilities. So they tend not to apply for a job if they don't meet all of the criteria. Whereas men are much more likely to just wing an application if they meet, say, 60% of the criteria. And part of that is about how job ads are worded in terms of bullet pointing the skills that are required. The women will actually look at that bullet point as, I must actually have every single one of these, rather than, this is our ideal candidate, and you don't have to be ideal to apply. So women are not applying for jobs they think that they're underqualified for, whereas men are. There's also an issue with the language that's used to discuss STEM and in the recruitment area. So we want to really help employers understand how to use language to get a broader spread of applicants. So for example, there's a company called Textio that has this massive database of job ads and also has hiring data to go with those ads. And what they have found is that gendered language in job ads corresponds to the gender of the hire. So you can read an ad and predict who will end up getting hired. And tech job ads are biased towards masculine language, which means that they're biased towards masculine hires. And this graph from Textio shows that even within tech, there's quite a broad variation in how masculine the job ads are. So machine intelligence job ads are very masculine, and that predicts a very heavy dominance of male hires, followed by sort of back-end and full-stack engineers, through to sort of like the research engineer or scientist, which is the least gendered of the tech areas that they looked at. So it's not just about connecting companies and women, it's also about teaching companies how to communicate with women. It's not just about, you know, the talent pool, it's about how we talk to them. There's also the need to understand motivation. So, for example, only 1 in 8 graduates is motivated primarily by salary. Students have a sense of the sort of nominal worth. How much do I think I should be earning? And once they hit that, once they're finding jobs at that level, the interest in the salary drops off. They're not motivated to look for a bigger and a bigger and a bigger salary. Quite often they're motivated by things like whether there's training for them, whether they have opportunities to progress, can they see a career path with this company. And women especially are motivated by jobs that have some form of social worth. So they're not really looking and saying, right, I can earn lots of money here. They want to contribute to society and they want a job that that demonstrates their contribution. And as a little, I don't have a slide for this, but as an aside, when you look at the gender split within STEM subjects, we are now seeing that medicine has something like 70% of undergraduates are women. Veterinary science is 70-75% of undergraduates are women. And this seems by some, they're interpreting this as a success, and that actually we are attracting women into these. Yeah, these are two of the most challenging degrees you can do, but actually both medicine and veterinary science have incredibly strong social worth. They make a difference. And so women are, in fact, not bucking the trend by doing those degrees. They're actually cleaving to the stereotype of, if I am to have a degree and a job, then it must be something that is societally important. The issue with employers is that they're not sufficiently explaining why their jobs are societally important. They're not actually explaining the social worth. And graduates are increasingly worried about the ethics of companies that they potentially might be working for. do we need employers to rethink how they talk about themselves as companies? So they can't just be about how financially successful and stable they are, it also has to be about their ethical values. There's also an issue about mobility. We have this assumption that we are a highly mobile society, that we can move from city to city, and whilst that is physically true, we can, people don't, and especially graduates do not like to move away from their hometown, especially women. They are far less mobile than companies assume. So what you're seeing is, for example, in Manchester, you've got students coming into Manchester University from places like Oldham, and then when they graduate, they're not getting jobs in Manchester. They're going back to Oldham, even though it's not that far away. And so you're seeing this sort of clustering and again, because women are more likely to have domestic care duties, they're more likely to be, the term if you're married is trailing spouse, that your husband goes and gets the job somewhere and you just follow behind. And so this is a common social pattern that women are taking secondary positions in their careers in order for their husbands or their partners to pursue what they want to pursue. So this is a major issue because what that means as well is that you have clusters of people in towns where there is not much employment in their field and they're refusing essentially to move to areas where they could get employment. Part of this is about confidence and confidence in their ability to adapt to a new town. So again, we need to do a better job of talking to women and graduates in general about how to cope with moving to a new town. So we have this sort of broad number of problems that are actually relatively easily solved. This is about communications. This is not about big structural barriers as much as it is about getting everybody in the same place, getting everybody actually talking about what's important, and recognising that there is some evidence of generational shifts in attitudes. So what worked for recruiting Gen Xers does not work for recruiting millennials and Gen Z kids. They have a different set of motivations, they have a different set of priorities. So I am very interested, the reason I'm kind of announcing this here is because I know there's a lot of people who might be employers or recruiters, maybe graduates, job hunters, anybody basically interested in this, come talk to me afterwards. And we are on all of the usual. And I also have my obligatory thank you to my sponsors, without which we wouldn't exist. And we are obviously always looking for new sponsors if your company might be interested. And thank you to our sponsors. And thank you for listening.
Extracting stories and narratives from that data, and with that, building all that up
and turning that into a four-part symphony. Everyone's kind of like, what?
Yeah.
I mean, okay, so this is essentially what we're trying to do is we're trying to use through a series of labs and open test beds, not necessarily just going off and swirling ourselves away in a hole somewhere and then coming out saying, look, mommy, here's my poo, but actually taking everybody, artists, scientists, journalists, people who are actually interested, and then clubbing them all together in one sweaty heap and having everybody work out the process together. And that also involves opening this up to the general public and opening yourself up to that kind of public scrutiny, that kind of debate, that kind of argument. And please, if anybody wants to call out bullshit at anything I'm saying, please feel free to do so right now at any point when we're talking.
Because later.
Or even later. But no, please, please do, because that kind of thing is exactly what we want. This is, you know, this kind of top-down hierarchy of us speaking and you listening is not exactly how this whole shit's meant to work. It's meant to be an interaction, and it's meant to be something that we're all building together because we all live on this planet and we're all eventually going to die on it. So, Jamie, if you'd like to, perhaps...
Very quickly.
Yeah.
Take through how we're doing it. We did this last in open text 2015.
Something like that. 16? No.
2015. Anyway, right.
15. Yeah, you remember.
That's a timeline. If you look at the top bit, it goes from 1994 to 2014. And so this is some data. And we took that bit of data, which is
let's see what that data is.
Arctic ice that freezes and melts, and we just mapped it like that. And hopefully the sound's going to work.
On the far end of that is a keyboard.
Hello. So let's press it again.
No, the sound. Shit.
Shit. Shit. Okay.
What is this? Age against the machine or no?
Age.
Can I say you look a little bit like Phil Collins singing on this one?
Oh, wait.
We can ignore the Canadian troll in the corner.
That's right.
Can we not do this on my public association shit as well? But the so the migratory patterns, those are migrants going from North Africa through into Lampedusa and the southern, sort of mostly Italy, but sometimes ending up in Greece and sometimes ending up in Cyprus. And the statistics of that, I don't have, my brain's just kind of farts, but we have at least where we got the stats for that in the sheet.
Same, that's the history of it.
Yeah, so the history. Yeah. Any other questions so far? Just kind of, yeah.
How come it sounds like good?
Because the end of the world is yeah, it's the end of the world and I feel fine. But essentially it is.
Did you have to curate the kind of the way the data mapped onto the
Yes notes? And no, because this is just basically means that, you know, this is all data that's pinned to things on text files or things that are already kind of graphed, and yes, you may, my dear.
Sorry. It's because we wanted it to sound good, so we rounded up and down to kind of suit. It's still got anchor in the data. But we made a decision for it to be
alternative data.
Good. Yeah, it's alternative.
definitely alternative data. The thing is, one of the things we definitely set was a time period, and we have to set certain things to it, otherwise it is going to be piggly and all over the fucking shop. So in this case,
it was like that. Well, actually, it wasn't like that. It was a bit better than that. But this is a lab that we ran in Brighton, where we invited other people to do it, and. It was, that's really bad, actually. But we had acetate paper, acetate of keyboard diagrams written, and people actually drew lines. So it has been as basic as that. But with the new labs that we're going to be doing, which we hope everyone will be interested in, it's suddenly gone to a stupid level of sophistication.
Yeah, so we're using a bit of tech called MaxMSP, which unfortunately is proprietary, but we're trying to find ways which ones that aren't. Jamie's acetate. Sorry, Doc? Can't hear you.
Pure data. Yeah, it is. Yeah, it's right.
But yes.
Let's talk about the thing. This is the breakdown of sonification. What we've learned about the actual.
Peter, how many different time, by the way?
7 minutes.
Great. No, that's less. Yeah, right. No, it's just like break. No. I think you keep talking.
Alright, we have now the labs are informing the discussion that we discovered around these subjects, which if you subdivide anything, it brings up this, what is it, moral sandwich, a thing? A sandwich.
It's the sandwich.
It's a sandwich.
And if you're a bit too heavy or a bit too small, you know, the sandwich starts falling apart. So at the top of the sandwich, we have accessibility, then we have the narrative, the story, the accuracy of the story, the art that goes into it, and then underneath it's the agenda.
These all have simultaneous feeling, but there's a load of things, might be at least hierarchy based on the actual layers of sandwich, you know, depending on how you like your sandwiches, you know.
Yeah, but I think quite more relevant is this.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's what I'm talking about. Yeah. But we're coming in, we're quite happy to talk about that.
I'm assuming that for those who can't read it, maybe you should. So the original premise behind this is essentially, you know, how can we engage people with climate change in a new and fresh way? Because climate change, as a kind of general subject, essentially sends people off to sleep and will make people just go, oh yeah, I know all about that, or it's not something that's particularly sexy or particularly engaging. However, if you actually involve people in the creation of a narrative, or at least in the telling of narratives, then there's a little bit more involvement, and then people are actually kind of like sit up like tiny meerkats and like, what's this new thing? Where does that kind of story end? Do we have any sacrifices on accuracy for this thing called accessibility? And we also ask ourselves, you know, why sonification, but why not? Because nobody else has ever done it before. I mean, you've done it in kind of academic sense, but nobody's ever really tried to tell stories this way. The data sonification in itself isn't necessarily new, it's been going on since 1986-87. But no one's ever actually tried to kind of form symphony or do something, you know, in terms of storytelling or doing journalism with it. In terms of full disclosure, I am everything that is wrong in the world. I'm Filipino and American. So yes, I mean there's a real threat, and that a lot of the data that is currently in the United States on climate change may no longer be available to people. And there is the Data Refuge Project, and there are other sort of various things that are happening that are people just swirling this away just in case. So yes, there is a way of being able to actually preserve some of this material in something that's a little bit more timeless than a spreadsheet and a text file that people can actually access. People can actually have a kind of feeling with. There is statistical evidence that there is a direct effect in the limbic part of your brain, and that's a good segue into Jamie.
Huh?
To talk about.
Okay, sorry, I wasn't listening. But sound is, okay, what are we talking about? Why are we sonifying anything?
Yeah, we're talking about the limbic system.
Why sonifying anything? Okay, we're doing it because sound is a gateway to the emotions. As we know, it's much more to the limbic system rather than what's the frontal lobe, the visual part. Because it's our primitive sense for survival. Therefore, we feel like it's a mechanism to allow people to sort of get past language in a lot of ways and just, I don't know, get back to the Earth, face, you know, or at least the demise of the Earth. Okay.
Yeah, next. So in next, what we're doing is we're doing a whole series of labs in London and in Newcastle. We've just received an email from somebody saying that they would like to have the Manila Symphony Orchestra maybe play with this, so which will be quite nice, which means I can go to a nice little country that goes bang bang again. There's talk about taking this to wherever those people are from, where they're in the corner, a bunch of international festivals. We will next also be appearing at the East End Film Festival, likely to be at the Union Chapel as well, some point later. And there will be a long time version which we are kind of working towards.
A real time.
Like a real thing.
Thingy.
Yeah, it's going to actually have to happen. But yeah, so the. No, because we would like to have some questions from people and we have to go as they are. And I'm very conscious of time, so.
Is this like a full 5 minute symphony, or can you just. I mean, there's loads of days that you could have, a week long.
I mean, in the ideal world, what we would do is we'd like to keep things intensely local. So when we go to Newcastle, we'd like to have a lot of local data from Newcastle and actually be able to tell the stories from that place and in that time with that material. So each place would sound different because of the people who are involved and also because it should. Who are we to impose one narrative to everybody else? Everybody's got their own narratives and why don't we just give their stories?
So it goes back to the sandwich. How do we
Man in the non-Nirvana shirt.
I don't know much about music, so tell me if this is a really dumb question. If I downloaded the MP3 of the symphony, would I be able to reverse engineer it and get the climate data out of it?
Yes. But surely we should be talking about the Arm Fortis.
Well, the Arm Fortis is not the flag.
If you reverse engineer it enough, you might cause a flood in Pakistan.
At some point, people will start using sound as a means of reporting as a reporting tool, as a recording tool, and as a way of actually being able to tell stories with each other. And I know that now it doesn't look very likely at all, but language evolves, and I want this to be part of that evolution, and I want to drag everybody along with it.